to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloen. If you've ever watched coverage of a major earthquake in California, like the ones that rocked Ridgecrest last summer, chances are you've seen Dr. Lucy Jones. For decades, she has been a trusted voice who can convey the complexities of seismology to the general public, especially in times of crisis, such as the hours and days following a major quake. Lucy Jones has appeared on late-night shows like Conan O'Brien's, dispensing pearls of wisdom on how to prepare for the inevitability of a big earthquake, especially on the San Andreas Fault. After serving as the science advisor for risk reduction for the United States Geological Survey's Pasadena office, Jones retired in 2016, but she hasn't retired from actively informing the public about disaster preparedness. Her new podcast, Getting Through It, aims to do just that. Help people get through disasters like the one we are now dealing with, the global COVID-19 pandemic, as well as preparing us to get through the next big earthquake. Lucy Jones joined us from her home in Southern California recently to talk about it. Lucy Jones, welcome to Blue Dot.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I've known about your work for many years, followed you through the USGS. You're kind of the lady who gives us the information on earthquakes in Southern California. So well known for that over the years. And you retired from the USGS in 2016.
Right.
But I noticed during the Ridgecrest earthquakes last summer, there you were again. So you come in out of retirement when you're needed?
Well, no, sort of. You can say, so here in Southern California, earthquakes are monitored by a cooperative project between Caltech and the U.S. Geological Survey. And early on, after I moved here, Caltech gave me an honorary appointment so that I was considered faculty on campus and, you know, because I was continuing to collaborate with a lot of scientists there. When I retired from the USGS, they asked me to keep that appointment and be able to come in and help them for their side of the project. So where I used to come in and say I work for the U.S. Geological Survey, now I come in as a representative of Caltech.
I see. And I'd like to know, when did you decide that you wanted to do a podcast?
This podcast really came out during the pandemic. I've had this nonprofit since about 2 years after I left the USGS. We formed it as a framework for being able to do work on science activation, how to help train people on doing science communication things. With the pandemic, it has been, it's so painful to look at our society ignoring science and people dying as a result. I mean, there's no other way to put what's going on right now. And many of the ways in which our society is suffering are places where we were already struggling. It's actually one of the things that's most common in disasters, that systems fail where they are already weak. And that applies to buildings and water pipes and levees, but it also applies to human systems. And the weaknesses in our society are where we are seeing problems. And much of this is tied into our difficulty with using evidence to support our decision-making. We, as a society, have reached a place where we're trying to make things true by believing them rather than by determining that they actually are true. And that can work in a lot of social settings, but you know, you can politically, you perhaps can get things to be true because you believe them strongly. But you know, the apple is not going to fly into the air when you release it just because you believe that gravity is not true, and the virus is not going to stop being transmitted because you don't want to believe that masks matter, and. So we're seeing really painful consequences, and it seemed like the time to try to really focus on using science, recognizing how you understand that something's true or not, and helping people get that different perspective, because our lives and our society really depend upon it right now.
I'd like to explore that a little further, because you and I are close to the same age, and grew up at a time when science was highly valued in the United States. In fact, you know, after Sputnik, you know, you had this real surge of science education and in what we would call STEM now. And that trickled down into the education system, and science seemed of great value. And why do you suppose it is that in the last decade or so, or couple decades, we've seen this kind of turning away or distrust of science and scientific, you know, authority, if you will?
Because we have an active effort within the United States to undermine scientific information. We prized capitalism. You do whatever is necessary to make your money. And if you manufacture cigarettes and science is saying they kill you, the best way to keep on marketing cigarettes is to undermine the science. And there was quite a bit done. You know, eventually it didn't work. We are seeing, people still smoke, right? But a lot was learned in that process about how to undermine belief in science. Because we still teach science, you know, on the larger scale in schools, to, you know, elementary school and high school, as a set of facts that you believe because the experts say they're true. And rather than as a process by which we come to understand what is true. And that is not a very secure foundation when the idea of expert is being undermined. So, you know, when you look at how people have been attacking scientific results, both with cigarettes and now with climate change, it only works because people don't understand how the process works. Now, you can show a discrepancy in one little corner of the data and imply that that means the whole thing falls apart. If you've been part of the scientific endeavor, you know that when you see a problem in a theory, either you need to tweak the theory because it's really just this really minor corner. The idea that you have to throw out the whole theory, if you're going to do that, then you need to deal with 100 other pieces of information that says the model is true. And so when you've been part, if you've ever written a research paper, if you've ever gotten involved at that level, you start recognizing that quibbling about one corner of the data is not the way to deal with it. But the general public doesn't get that because we've never taught it as a general process. And so I see a variety of things. There's a concerted effort to undermine it. I think the way in which we have taught it in school has been too dependent upon the idea of the expert. And we also have this sort of anti-elitism trend in America. It's all the anti-intellectual part in America. It's always been true. So the post-Sputnik time was rather an aberration, if you will, where we valued it more. But the anti-intellectual trend is something that's been part of American culture, an aspect of American culture for a long time. So I think it's a bunch of different things coming together at this point, probably more extreme than we've seen it in a lot of times in the past. And at this point, I think really endangering our lives.
Yeah. And for example, I went to a grocery store very early this morning. And I go very early on weekday mornings to try to avoid, as you know, people as much as possible. And I wear a mask. And there's a sign right there as you walk in the door that, you know, the state, you know, the new state request that everybody wear a mask in places like that. And yet, what do I see? I see 3 out of 5 people not wearing a mask. And, you know, when I see them, I just head the other way as fast as possible. And it's become like some kind of strange badge of courage, you know, or something that, I don't wear a mask. You know, I'm not one of you, you know, crazy science scared people. I don't know what the thinking is, but they just like deliberately they feel like it's a part of their moral code not to wear a mask, and it's bizarre to me.
It's a rejection of the need of the group. Right? If you are aggressively individualistic and you don't want the group to ever have a demand on you, that's part of what's going on in this process. And again, it's there's a tension in all of human society. There's sort of that move to have the common good and helping the community, wanting to be part of something bigger than yourself, versus the individual's need to try, you know, the evolutionary drive of how do I protect myself? And you see it as a tension in a lot of different human decisions. Public health is a place where we have to put the common good against our, you know, above our individual needs, because in the end it comes back and gets us too. But you have to see that bigger group as part of it. And that's, again, and, you know, there's a strand of American society that that is hyper individualistic. And it's been more prevalent, I'd say, in the last decade. And it's also, I mean, look at the way we've rejected taxes, and we have this huge increase in income inequality. That's partly the whole rejection of taxes is rejection of an idea that you contribute to the group for the good of everyone. And it's a statement that I'm an individualist and nobody takes anything away from me. And how do you deal with that? Those are people that are actually harming you because they're saying my individual needs are more important than your health. And so one of the ways I do it, I don't go into a grocery store if I see a bunch of people without masks. And, you know, that I think that the more of us that can say that, I sometimes say, you know, I wear a mask to say I care about my community. To take care of myself, I don't enter a building where people are wearing masks. Because, you know, one of the other things that's really clear about the pandemic at this point is that most transmission is happening inside. There's a study out of China where they were able to track down how transmission happened in over 7,000 cases, and one of them happened outside, which was a group of men in a village talking outside for a long time. And I know the cultural norms there, they probably were standing very close together, much more than we're comfortable with in the United States. There's another case supposedly of at a soccer game. So a couple of people near it, you know, but where you're crammed in together, even though you're outside, you're sitting beside the person for several hours and you're yelling, which emits more virus. So we have really, you know, you can take care of yourself by staying outside and staying away from people without masks.
Yeah. And one of the things in your first podcast that I really appreciate is where you said, it's like, you know, here's a tip. If you go into a building and people are not wearing a mask, leave, don't go in there.
Yeah. That's the way to keep yourself safe.
And gosh, it makes me wonder about what's going to happen across California when schools reopen, you know, because you're going to have thousands and thousands of kids in rooms.
They're not talking about coming back the way they were. I know I've been hearing from a local school district, giving some advice to a preschool, and then sort of looking at the larger school district. They're talking about, alternating days that you come in, having the option of being a completely remote learning. I mean, it's going to be really challenging for the school districts to do this. The other thing is when you're looking at, especially the smaller schools, at least we're in California, we can be outside. And for a large, you know, if we just said most school activities are happening outside, set up the desks outside, that would be so much safer. The other thing is kids can learn to wear masks, and that will make a huge difference too. I know one friend of mine, is his little two-year-old, saw mommy was getting ready to go out and she wanted to go with her. So she ran and got her mask and put it on, because that's what you do when you go outside. Yeah. Kids can learn this.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with seismologist Lucy Jones. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's continue now with our conversation with Dr. Lucy Jones. After retiring from the United States Geological Survey, the famous seismologist founded the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society and is producing a new podcast called Getting Through It. Well, and another thing that I've, you know, and I'm sure you've thought about this, is we're dealing with this pandemic, which is, you know, very difficult on all of the state's infrastructure, you know, when you look at what's going on with the economy. I'm sure that you have thought about what happens when you throw a natural disaster on top of this, because that could happen in California, you know, with wildfires, and of course, an earthquake. And have you been thinking much about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there's one level at which, if we had a big earthquake, we're going to ignore the pandemic for a while, at least for a day or two. Because, you know, I'm not going to, you know, I don't see people refusing to dig someone out of the building that's collapsed because they might be contagious from COVID-19. And there will be some level at which we'll just deal with that. And, you know, there might be a little spike right around there because of that. The bigger problem is going to be if we really disrupt our housing because of it. The traditional model of, you know, a big shelter with 2,000 people in it, I don't think so, right? Yeah. But again, you know, can we figure out a way to do it outside? Or put up a, you know, some sort of tarp to be, you know, keeping people out? So I think we can find inventive ways of dealing with it. And we will. But also, whenever you think about any disaster, either the earthquake or the pandemic, there is, we talk about two phases. There's the response when you're the immediate adrenaline-driven action that you take to reduce the losses, to keep people from dying. And that's a time when people tend to be very altruistic. Then there's the recovery at which, you know, the immediate risk has passed and we're now trying to get things back, all the things that we've lost. And the economic recovery from big disasters can take decades. I mean, New Orleans still has a much smaller population than it had before Hurricane Katrina hit. If you look at what happened to San Francisco after the 1906 earthquake, it was decades before it came back to anything like it had really been before.
Yeah, I was just up in Paradise, California, where I'm from, and it was the first visit I've had in several months, you know, over a year. And, you know, it's coming back, and nature is reclaiming it, and, you know, the green is coming back. But there's definitely not going to ever be the same number of people living there. That's just not going to recover. That town is not coming back the way it was, which is probably a good thing. But, you know, you're right. It's going to take a long time for that town to come into any semblance of really being a community again.
Right. And it's going to have to be a different sort of community. And, you know, when I think if you look at the pandemic as a disaster, it's killed way more people than any earthquake. Mm-hmm. And the economic devastation is, you know, greatly exceeding what we probably would be doing. Even though we don't have, you know, direct losses of buildings, we sure have losses of jobs, and the economic impact is going to be huge. And it's a global disaster. So we don't have someone else to turn to help us. We're all going through this. And I think we're going to see a lot of the same things. And if you, you know, combine the economic disruption from the pandemic with the economic disruption of an earthquake, it's going to be even harder to recover from. And I think that rather than the response phase, I think the recovery, I'm already worried about the economic recovery from this disaster. It's a potential, if we can recognize what it is and really take it as an opportunity to change some fundamental issues, you know, especially like around jobs. One of the things, again, American society, well, this is human, right? When we see somebody suffering, we try to come up with a reason of why it's their fault. Because if it's their fault, I can make sure it doesn't happen to me by not making the same mistakes. So think about it when you hear somebody's had a heart attack. Don't you jump to the, well, look, yeah, she was carrying a bit of extra weight there. Boy, she should have been exercising more, right? Mm-hmm. That, those are mental constructs that allow us to think, I'm not going to suffer the same thing. And it's a very human thing. We see it in disasters on a bigger scale. You know, why didn't those people evacuate, even though there was no mechanism for evacuating if you didn't own a personal car? You know, that type of it's a way of feeling safer. We do it about poverty too. We don't want to think that I could get hit by a car today and then I wouldn't be able to do my job and suddenly I don't have the resources to keep on going. That's a really scary thought. We would much rather believe that people who don't have jobs are somehow bad people and deserve it, because then it's not going to happen to me because I know I'm a good person and I make the right choices. And we have a pretty, when you really look back at how we think about people who are poor, we mostly consider it their fault. We ignore all of the structural issues that make it difficult to get out or to get yourself, you know, if you can't get childcare because, you know, because you're already poor, you can't do the things that are necessary to get you out. And we go and celebrate the people who do manage to get out of it because, see, it was really there being good people and those other people are bad people. And that's a pretty deeply ingrained thing into our society about how we feel about people being poor or out of work.
It's the old pull yourself up by your bootstraps argument.
Right. I think why is because then we can say, I deserve my financial security and I don't have to feel guilty that I've got it and they don't. And it's just a matter of random chance or that something could just happen and I'm suddenly lost all of this. And it's a sort of a, it's a way of defending yourself against the fear that you could be happening. Looking forward, you know, think about all of the changes that have happened in the workplace over our lifetimes. We suddenly don't need a lot of jobs that we used to need. Think about secretaries typing your paper for you. That's all gone. Now we're seeing, you know, the disruption of retail and how many people are no longer being employed in stores, which the pandemic disruption is obviously going to be accelerating. Lots of stores aren't going to be coming back from this. Right now we have all of these delivery jobs, but it's not that far out before we have self-guided vehicles and we're going to lose all those delivery jobs. I've seen some estimates that not very far in the future, you know, 20, 30 years, that we'll only need to employ like 20% of our population to be able to have the same level of economic activity and wealth generation. The problem is, if we just say, okay, if you don't have a job, it's your fault and you're supposed to suffer and we're not going to help you out because that'll somehow be rewarding your bad behavior, that same wealth generation is now going to be going to a much smaller group of people. That's not a society that's going to function if we only have jobs for 20% of the population. But why do we think it's so important that you have to work to show that you deserve to not starve? You know, imagine if we had universal basic income and now you could actually devote yourself to being a musician, which plenty of people would like to be able to do and can't afford it because there's just not enough money in that. But if we, you know, able to separate this out, obviously you'd get rewarded more if you actually have one of those jobs. But, you know, that's a place we could, I have to admit, I think that we're going to have some version of that to have a society that it doesn't tear itself apart when we only have jobs for 20% of the population.
Yeah, and I think we got a glimpse of that with the stimulus checks.
That's what I'm talking about. I think that this pandemic is showing us a glimpse of that future. Mm. And different countries are handling it in different ways, you know. I mean, there's plenty of countries facing the same thing or sending a couple $1,000 to people every month just because that's what you got to do. Or, you know, making sure that they keep on getting their salaries even though they're not working. We haven't really done that because we have a stronger feeling that being poor is a moral failing. And, you know, if there's a silver lining to the pandemic, maybe the disruption that it does to our society will allow us to look at some of these issues. But we have more, information with which to consider those decisions when we really use what science can tell us, recognizing that the future is likely to be only 20% of the people needing to work.
Well, if we can, I'd like to shift gears to talk about your area of real expertise, which is earthquakes, because I find it fascinating and important. And it's something that we are going to be dealing with in California and the West, in Oregon and places like that. It's just, you know, as you and your colleagues always say, it's a matter of when, not if. We just recently had an earthquake in Lone Pine, and I'm wondering, you know, what your thoughts are on that and the activity there.
Well, all right. So we had a year ago, of course, we had the Ridgecrest earthquake that was a magnitude 7.1. In the last few months, we've been seeing quite a bit of activity around the edges of what we call the Basin and Range Province. So that's the area from the Sierra Nevada in California on the west over to the Wasatch Mountains of Utah on the east. And the area in between is bulging up and stretching out. And you see these series, what's called basin and range, because you have basins and ranges forming along normal faults. These earthquakes, you know, we're seeing earthquakes around the edges of that process. There's two separate issues. One's geologic time and geologic time and human time have very little overlap, right? Yeah. Geologic time, like millions of years, a lot of us think that there's a shift in the shape of the plate boundary for the Pacific Ocean and the North American plate, and that at least some of the motion is diverting up over there onto the eastern side of the Sierras away from the San Andreas Fault. It's not clear how that'll work out. And since it's going to happen over the next 5 or 10 million years, I'm not going to be able to test any of these models. But because if we shift the plate boundary into the continent up to, then we have to somehow reconnect back somewhere farther north. And it's not at all clear how that would happen. But it does look like the area through Owens Valley up into Western Nevada is gradually forming into a more through-growing fault. It's not there yet. So we have lots of little faults, and we have, a 6 or a 7 isn't a little earthquake, but it's not a magnitude 8. There's not yet a through-going feature like we have on the San Andreas, but it's developing. All of that said, I said, it's geologic time. That's sort of irrelevant to any issue of what earthquakes we're going to be seeing. Mm-hmm. And on the long run, we know that for hundreds of years, there are earthquakes along there. If they happen less frequently than along the San Andreas system, but we've had them in the past. There's some magnitude 7s that happened in Western Nevada, 1915 and 1954. The Owens Valley Fault had probably 7.5 in 1872. We've had the 7 in Ridgecrest. So clearly it is a band of activity that on human timescales will continue to have earthquakes like this.
Yeah. In your most recent podcast, you had some interesting thoughts. You got some great questions about this from your co-host, John, about how earthquakes are named. And I would like to know a little more about how do earthquakes get their names? Like, for example, let me take the largest one that I know of in California anyway, 1857. Why is it called the Fort Tejon earthquake?
Because seismologists gradually agreed to use the term. And the only people who died in that earthquake, there were two people stationed at Fort Tejon, and Fort Tejon collapsed, and people died there. So the early records of the earthquake, before they understood faults, before they understood how the spatial distribution happens, the only place where people are dying are in Fort Tejon. That's the name that got associated with it. And the process of naming them really is, we agree to use it. And there's sort of the media will jump to using a term because that's where people were died or people were hurt. Will sometimes be somewhat in conflict. It's like, you know, the World Series earthquake, 1989, right? People wanted to call it the San Francisco earthquake or the World Series earthquake. And the scientists are going, no, it's up in the mountains. It wasn't in San Francisco. So they named it after a mountain, the Loma Prieta earthquake. It's had mixed success because nobody knows where Loma Prieta is. And so they've had challenges trying to keep that name associated with it. So we always try to find a balance when we pick a name to use. And literally the seismologist will pick a name, hopefully before the media come running in. And you guys all get there faster now than used to. So it's getting more of a challenge to come up with a name quickly, where we're trying to recognize where the earthquake happened, keep people focused on that aspect of it. One that's likely to be used, it isn't too long. Like the Northridge earthquake, I wanted to call it the Western San Fernando Valley earthquake, because it was under the whole Western San Fernando Valley. It wasn't just at Northridge. We decided that was too long. We talked about calling it the Northridge Hills. Oh, that's one of the other ones. We try not to name it after cities because people get upset at us for that. Like the people in Northridge were really upset that we called it the Northridge earthquake because it made them look worse. The people in Reseda, because after we finished really doing all the analysis, the actual epicenter was in Reseda by like a quarter of a mile away from Northridge. And they were like, you didn't name it after us because we're a poorer community. And they were like feeling, you know, short shrift because we hadn't named it after them when it was actually there. So it's sort of weird when we name it for towns. We try to avoid that if possible. But the Northridge Hills has a Northridge Hills fault, and this earthquake wasn't on the Northridge Hills fault, so we rejected that. And by the time we waffled around, the media was already calling it Northridge, and we stuck with it.
Well, I'll just tell you, as somebody who lived in Northridge in the 70s and went to high school in Reseda at Grover Cleveland High School, I can see both sides of that argument.
Like, people get really emotional about how we use the name. So we try to separate it out, but it doesn't always work that way. And actually, with Ridgecrest, we were first talking about calling it Searles Valley. And then people were like, we don't know where Searles Valley is. We know where Ridgecrest is. That's where the damage is. We're going to go with that name.
Yeah. So if let's say the 1857 earthquake were to repeat itself or happen today, exactly what happened that many years ago, what do you think it might be called today?
It might be called the Southern California earthquake, to represent just how large an area is actually involved. That's one of the debates that we have, is whether or not we should do that. Some, we might call it the San Andreas earthquake, or the Southern San Andreas earthquake, or the Central San Andreas earthquake. That's the problem. It's also, we call that part of the San Andreas often the Mojave segment of the San Andreas. Mm-hmm. That, it might end up being called Mojave. We should probably actually be ready for that. Though the more likely earthquake is the one farther south, that would run from Palm Springs up through San Bernardino and who knows how far north it might go.
And what might you call that?
I would probably argue for the Southern San Andreas earthquake, because that's a physical thing rather than a community name. So many communities will be devastated by that event. We wouldn't want to try and separate that out. But those biggest ones are hard, because a bigger earthquake is on a longer fault. You know, a 7.8 is going to be a fault that's like 200 miles long. Think of how many communities you have in Southern California if you extend for 200 miles. And every one of them is on the fault, even if the epicenter, when we did the modeling for that earthquake with the shakeout, the epicenter is down at the Salton Sea. I wouldn't want to call it the Salton Sea earthquake, though, because the fault starts at the Salton Sea and goes all the way to Palmdale. Or beyond Palmdale.
The part that ruptures.
The part that ruptures. And every point on that fault's giving off energy. It's not like it's all radiating out of Salton Sea.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. So, because I want you to kind of give us a little earthquake 101 here. And I think this is a good spot to talk about it. You of course, are associated with Caltech and Pasadena, which is where Charles Richter famously came up with the Richter scale. And we no longer use the Richter scale, despite what, sometimes you hear in the media by people who don't really know what they're talking about. Can you explain to us how you use the size of a fault's breaking, the size of the fault involved in an earthquake, how that really relates to that magnitude number?
Okay. So yes, Richter came up with the concept of magnitude. And in that sense, we're still using what he did. And the idea is that magnitude is one number representing the total energy released in the earthquake. And you hear about it going up as a factor of 10. That's the amount of vibration at a particular site, but it's over a bigger area and a longer time. The energy actually goes up by a factor of 32 for each unit of magnitude. So it began as a completely empirical thing based off of measuring the displacement on a seismogram and was trying to represent the idea that there was one size to the earthquake that wasn't what you felt. What you felt depends on how far away you are from it and all sorts of other factors. As we came to understand more about earthquakes, I mean, when Richter did this, it wasn't even yet generally accepted that earthquakes happened on faults, especially some of the ones that were underwater. People thought there might be other mechanisms involved. Now that we know that they're on faults and we can see that it is an area of a fault that moves one side past another, that releases the shaking you feel as one of the effects of that moving, just like when I snap my fingers, I'm moving my thumb past my finger that releases a sound wave, and that sound wave is like the shaking that you feel in the earthquake. The area that's involved, the more area, the more energy released, because each point gives off energy. And then usually there's a scale in between how much one side slides past the other. It's able to move more when it's a bigger fault that's getting moving. There's momentum issues and various things. So the bigger earthquakes are happening over a larger fault, and there's more movement of one side past the other. Now, I say a whole area moves. It doesn't all move at once. The epicenter is the point on the fault where it starts to move. And then there's a rupture front that moves down the fault, releasing energy as it goes. Just like if you were to try and tear a piece of paper, you wouldn't try to pull the whole thing apart at once. You'd notch it at the side and then rip from one side across the other. And same thing in the earthquake. You've got this rupture front moving down it at a very specific speed, about 2 miles a second. So a longer fault lasts for a longer time. So the bigger earthquakes last for a longer time. The best way to guess how big an earthquake is that you're feeling is not how much shaking you're feeling, but rather try to count how long you have strong shaking. And if it's under a second, it's something under magnitude 5. But as you get into your bigger earthquakes, they last for a longer time. And the big Fort Tejon earthquake lasted for about 100 seconds.
Wow. So, and you can really, as you experience an earthquake and the first shaking starts, you can kind of do some citizen science yourself just by counting and getting a feel for how long that earthquake lasts.
I always start counting the minute I feel it. Now, there's also the P and S wave, right? Mm-hmm. Which is two types of waves that come off the fault. The P wave is a sound wave, and it travels at about 4 miles a second or so. And then the S wave comes off of it, which is a twisting motion. It's always bigger than the P wave in an earthquake. It's one of the ways we tell the difference between a bomb and an earthquake, is the bomb has more energy in the P wave and the earthquake in the twisting S wave. And it travels at about 2 miles a second. So the time between the arrival of the P wave and the arrival of the S wave can tell you how far away the epicenter of the earthquake is, the beginning of the rupture. Just like, you know, do you ever count the time between lightning and thunder?
Sure.
Right? And that's about, 5 seconds per mile, about 1,000 feet per second for, mm-hmm. you know. Right? So it's 5 seconds per mile with the thunder and lightning. It's 5 miles per second on the earthquake. So if you feel it starts to shake, you start to count, and say 4 seconds later, a stronger wave comes in, then you've got 4 seconds between the P and the S wave, and the earthquake's about 20 miles away.
Now, when you said that the P wave is a compression wave, like in a slinky, if you wanted to make a model of it for kids at home, parents with kids teaching them stuff, and then an S wave would be more like a rope-like wave, which you could also do with a slinky.
Right, twist sideways with that one.
Yeah, it's a transverse wave, as they're called. So if it's a sound wave, I'm trying to remember from my experience with earthquakes, it's the 1971 earthquake that I was in. Do you hear the P waves as a rumble coming through the ground? Because I seem to recall that, you would hear this booming sound and then the shaking. Is that, does that, Does that happen?
Yeah, it does. How far away were you from the San Fernando earthquake? Where were you?
Well, I lived in Northridge. So it was in Sylmar, and that area there was near the epicenter up in the mountains.
Right. There was probably some shaking that was associated with it, and it can go either way, whether you perceive it as a sound or as motion. Often, you know, if it's not too big an earthquake or you're far away, we might miss the P wave, and what we feel first is the S wave. That's why I said, if you feel a second wave coming in, once I started counting, I found the time, and then if a bigger wave comes in, I start counting again, and it's that duration of strong shaking in the S wave that gives you the magnitude. But a lot of people do perceive it as a sound. I heard the earthquake coming, you'll hear people say. Mm-hmm. That's perceiving the P wave through the sound rather than through the ground. We've also, this is the one place where the tails of animals will probably come from, is that there will often be a case where the animal will feel the P wave or perceive the S wave or the P wave in some way, and the less sensitive human misses it. And then, so they seem to jump up and react 2 or 5 or 10 seconds before the earthquake. The earthquake is perceived by the human. If they knew 5 seconds before, why not 5 minutes or 5 hours? And what about that stomach ache they had yesterday? So that's a really common phenomenon. And we've seen it on a lot of videos too. You'll see the animal jump up and then the human respond a few seconds later.
If you're just joining us, I'm Dave Shlom, and we're talking to seismologist Lucy Jones about her new podcast, Getting Through It, about how to prepare and cope with disasters from earthquakes and wildfires to, you guessed it, pandemics. We are going to take a short break, but stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's get back now to our conversation with seismologist Dr. Lucy Jones.
So the other thing about earthquakes, they release all this energy, and they do it in a variety of frequencies. And when you're nearby, you receive all of them, and your body really responds to the higher frequencies, the jerky motions, and people will talk about the earthquake being a jolt or whatever. When you're farther away, the high frequencies attenuate more quickly than the low frequencies. Think about if you had a car with the music blaring going down the street. As they go away, what's left, you're just hearing the drum beat coming out of the music. That's the long period sound waves traveling farther than the short period waves. You can't figure out what the melody is, but you can hear the beat. Same thing happens in earthquakes. So when you're a long ways away from an earthquake, you're left only with the longer period motions. I actually remember just a few years after I came back to California and started working for the USGS, we had a spate of earthquakes, 3 separate earthquakes, North Palm Springs, this was in 1986, a magnitude 5.9 on the San Andreas in Southern California and near North Palm Springs. A week later, there's a 5.5 offshore of Oceanside. And then another like 10 days, 2 weeks later, 10 days later, I think there was a 6.5 up in the Mammoth area. It was, I was also 8 months pregnant at the time. So it was sort of like, oh, everything coming at you. But that 6.5, I was sitting at home with my husband and we were sitting at the breakfast table but we were sitting quietly. So this really long period motion, it started shaking really slowly. And we looked at each other and was like, if that's an earthquake, that must be a long ways away. If that's an earthquake that's a long ways away, it must be pretty big.
Yeah, and that leads to, as we talk about this, I'm thinking about how we are using the P and S wave arrival time difference for the shake alert app on the phones, because they aren't predicting an earthquake. They're letting you know an earthquake's underway, and depending on how far away the epicenter is, that's how much warning time you get. I want to get your take on, you know, there was so much criticism or whatever, however you want to look at it, from people in this in Los Angeles, you know, thinking that didn't work or didn't work well enough. You know, it's like, well, you were really far away, so, you know, you weren't going to feel any intense shaking from Ridgecrest. I wonder, you know, what's your take on the Shake Alert app and process, and what are some tweaks you guys think should be made to that to make it even more effective?
So let me give the caveat. I am not actively working on it now. When I was with the USGS, I was heavily involved in getting the funding in and promoting, you know, saying, why should we be doing this? And also looking at how communication would happen. And I had argued, if we have it and the decision was made, okay, this was actually after I had left the USGS, that they would only be issuing alerts for stronger shaking because people didn't need it when there was a small one, and you shouldn't be crying wolf and saying there's going to be shaking. And I was like, you know what's going to happen. People are going to feel an earthquake, and especially if you've got a big one, so you're feeling it really far away, the shaking isn't that strong. We say they don't need to know, but they feel it as a big earthquake. They're going to be really upset. It was so predictable that this would happen. And the solution is to have two levels of alerts, to have one, be aware, earthquake shaking's coming, versus drop, cover, hold on, strong shaking's coming. And I think they're going to be moving to that, and I think that that's what needs to be done, because, right, you don't feel an earthquake very often. The other thing is, if you only restrict it to strong shaking, then people, you know, might get an alert once every 10 years. And what are they going to know to do? They're going to have turned it off on their phone by then. They're not going to remember how to use it, what they're going to do. Having the smaller earthquakes gives you practice. But also, you know, you get the warning. It's not going to be that bad. Then you don't have to be so scared. You know,
the system's working.
And you know, the system's working. It gets to be tested. Mm-hmm. And it's a psychological issue too. You know, Japan set this up, of course, long before we did. And it was working for the 2011 magnitude 9 earthquake that they had. And it had been available before then, but mostly people hadn't gotten it. And in the month after that earthquake, there were over 1 million downloads of the app, phone app, in the next month, because people found it helped them cope with the aftershocks. You know, when you're that feeling, when you feel an earthquake beginning and you go, okay, that one wasn't that bad, right? But there's that adrenaline surge. Is this going to be the bad one? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that, imagine that before you get that, you get a notice that says you're going to be getting weak shaking. You know, there's a magnitude 4 somewhere nearby. Then you can just sort of enjoy it.
Yeah.
I know sometimes when I've gotten earthquake warnings, because I've, you know, being part of the development, I was able to have it on my computer before it was out generally available, as we were trying to test and see whether it was working. And, you know, getting a notice that really weak shaking was going to be arriving and sitting really still so I could feel it as it comes through, and loved it.
You get to be a seismic surfer, because that way you can, you know, you can know, it's like, hey, you know, this is like a 3-foot swell at Malibu, and that's going to be fun. I don't want anything to do with Mavericks.
Exactly. You know, that's a really big difference between the earthquake that you can feel, or even, you know, that, hey, this is a good ride, versus the one that's going to be, you know, throwing everything around your room.
Terrifying. Yeah. Well, before we let you go, let's go back to your podcast. What are some things you got planned coming up? You know, friend, give our listeners a pitch for subscribing to you. How do they do that? And what are some topics you want to tackle in the near future?
Okay, well, we do have it out available through podcast services. It's on our website. So I have the drlucyjonescenter.org. The last 3 episodes are always going to be up there. Supporters that get in through Patreon can get the full archive, and we'll be keeping them there. And, you know, we're trying to give a balance between sort of the topical issues like why do masks matter versus the sort of longer term basic ideas of how do we understand earthquake processes and what are the, you know, the long-term models or something like that. And we're going to cover a range of things. Try to talk about disasters, obviously, because it's a place where people are afraid and where science can really make a difference. We're also going to try to really be exploring some of the social sciences, because there's a lot of really good research about how people respond to things, and especially what we're seeing here in what's happening to our society through this pandemic. The social sciences have a lot to teach us. So I'm hoping to cover a variety of topics, but really look at not just, so here's what the science says, let's think about what this means for our society. As we get through this time when society's changing so much, I want to be talking about some of the important ideas that'll help us understand where we're heading and how we could do it differently. So it's going to be science with society, with the community, and hopefully helping people work together during this time.
Well, best of luck with that. And
the other thing is that are going to be doing some episodes about climate change, and we've been using music to help people hear just how big the climate change difference, how much things have really changed, because we can hear things with sound that it's difficult for us to comprehend by looking at graphs.
Well, Dr. Lucy Jones, thanks so much for spending the time with us and a fascinating array of topics we went over today. And join us again sometime.
This is great. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks to our guest, Dr. Lucy Jones. You can check out her podcast, Getting Through It, by going to the website for the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX, and if you missed an episode or want to share one, check out our archives at mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcast via the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.